Hello and welcome to Media Law and Ethics, a podcast series from the School of Communication at Radford University. I'm Professor Bill Kovarik and I'm serving as your guide through this course. This is the third in our podcast series out of 10 for the course. This podcast is about ethics, which involves what is right, equitable, fair, just, dutiful, and responsible. Ethical practice is as important in the media as it is in any other walk of life with high levels of public impact. It's especially important to emphasize ethics in media law, since what is legal is sometimes not what is ethical. So, for instance, it may be perfectly legal to disclose the name of a witness to a crime before a trial, but it could be highly unethical, since it can expose a witness to intimidation from people who are accused. And even when a public trial is held, journalists usually withhold the names of juvenile offenders and rape victims out of ethical concern. On the other hand, it may very well be illegal to publish information about a government agency's mistakes, and yet there are cases where journalists don't refrain from doing that because they're following their ethical sense of duty. And certain kinds of advertising also may be perfectly legal and yet push social boundaries into ethically unacceptable directions. The tendency to emphasize anorexically thin body shapes, for example, is considered today to be marginally ethical or even unethical, depending on the approach taken. So how do we assess all these challenges? All professionals have specific ethical codes that are based on long tradition. Probably the best known is the Hippocratic Oath, in which a physician will vow to do no harm. In media, the Society of Professional Journalists says that a journalist should minimize harm and have compassion for those who may be affected adversely by news coverage. In the American Advertising Federation and Public Relations Society of America, there are professional ethical codes that have to do with veracity and with fidelity to the objectives of the organization. So we need to have an ethical toolkit from which to assess all of these challenges. And we'll look at the ethics page on the website for more information about this. And that's at www.radford.edu/wkovarik. And then look for the law link and look for the link inside the law pages to ethics, as we've discussed before. But first, I want to make an observation and then maybe a few short stories from my own experiences as a reporter. So I attended recently at Virginia Tech a lecture by a science professor who asked whether ethics could be taught. And of course, the first reaction of a lot of the students there was that you can't teach something that's so personal. People are either ethical or they're not. Well, I agree with this in a way, but I think maybe we're asking the wrong question. Whether or not ethics is a sense that can be cultivated and improved. I think it's a natural sense, and it has to do with a natural sense of empathy between people. It's kind of like freedom, which is a natural right. I mean, we don't teach freedom, but we do have to learn about the responsibilities and systems of law that balance one person's freedom against another person's. So in that way, ethics is a way to balance what is right and fair for ourselves against what is right and fair for other people. And there are various ways to do it, and we'll talk about those four or five basic ethical principles in a minute. But it's always good to start off with some ideas about the kinds of ethical problems that you might run into. So here's a few ethical dilemmas for you, and these are all true stories. Let's say there's a civil rights demonstration and your managing editor happens to be very prejudiced and doesn't want the story covered. This actually happened to me some years back. So he tells you to go, but not to write about the demonstration unless there's violence, and then to only write about the violence. So what do you do? What's the ethical thing to do in that situation? Or here's another one. Let's say somebody's been arrested in a murder case, and the local district attorney tells you all about the evidence that they're bringing to trial, and how they've nearly got a confession, and the accused is a bad character and has lots of prior arrests. This is all information that's designed to influence potential jurors who will be reading a newspaper or listening to your broadcast. Do you write about that? Is that something that you should do? Or let's say that you're in advertising and somebody brings you an ad for something that you know is fraudulent. So for instance, I was once asked to help someone set up a website to advertise a new way to process toxic waste. And when I looked into it, it seemed technically impossible. So in all these kinds of cases, you're going to fall back on four basic ethical tools. What would be the right thing to do? That's virtue ethics. What effect would it have on yourself and other people? That's consequence ethics. what's your professional responsibility or duty ethics, and what would be the just or socially equitable thing to do. That's justice ethics. So you apply these ideas in the situations, and you come out with a kind of balance between the different sorts of actions that you could take. In the case of the demonstration, I had a responsibility to do what my editor told me to do, but I also had a higher duty to my sense of professional ethics and also to my sense of social justice. I thought about the consequences. I could lose my job, but then also for other people, going along with something that was wrong would have an effect on them. And I thought about what felt right and virtuous and decided to go ahead and write the story. And the outcome of the whole situation was simply that I turned the story in. They didn't run it the first day. There were protests. There were discussions about whether or not the story should run. And eventually the managing editor got into trouble, and not me, because he was the one who was asking me to do something that was kind of unethical. So I did my job and let him go ahead and do his job. And in terms of the pretrial publicity case, this actually happened in Pulaski County about 10 years ago, and there was a mistrial declared because there had been so much pretrial publicity. The people who did not report the story as seen by the local district attorney did not win the approval of their editors, and so there was a lot of pressure on the reporters to go ahead and report what the district attorney was saying. But in the end, the court system disciplined him, and the accused person ended up having to plead to a lesser charge, and I think the whole thing just was a big mess because there wasn't a sense of ethics and justice at work in the situation. In the case of the advertising request and the website request, I just said, you know, unless you can prove to me that this works, I can't do it. It's just not ethical and it's not right. So in all these cases, we try to balance virtue ethics, consequence ethics, duty ethics, and justice ethics. And let me just briefly touch on each one. Virtue ethics is really a Greek and Judeo-Christian philosophical tradition that says that your long-term happiness is only going to be found through acting virtuously or being good. And this was the idea that the Greeks had, that the value of using human reason was to get beyond simple appeals to authority or circular religious arguments. So an appeal to authority or an appeal by an authority would not necessarily work for a person who is being virtuous. The tradition includes the golden mean, the idea that we need to seek moderation in all things, and that good is usually found between the extremes, or the truth is found between the two different sides. So that's virtue ethics. Consequence ethics is also called utilitarian ethics, and it involves considering the greatest good for the greatest number of people. So that would include yourself, but it would also include many others. So the virtue of an action is determined by its outcome. And you can take this to an extreme and say that the greatest good for the majority might be pretty bad for a minority. And that is a criticism of utilitarian ethics that people who favor duty ethics have leveled. Among others, Immanuel Kant, who said that we should do what would be right if everybody did it. He called this the categorical imperative. It's not the consequences that make an action right or wrong, but the motives of the person doing them, the duty of that person. A typical example of duty ethics, or also known as deontological ethics, or the categorical imperative, would be that you don't walk on the grass because if everybody walked on the grass, it would kill the grass in that particular spot. But some people go ahead and walk on the grass anyway, and they're not following the categorical imperative in that sense. Well, duty and consequence ethics don't quite go far enough, and virtue ethics can be a little fuzzy. So a philosopher who lived until very recently, John Rawls, came up with a theory of social justice or justice ethics. And that was seen as a new alternative to utilitarian and duty ethics. And the idea was that social choices should be made in a non-self-serving way from an unbiased position. And, for example, in terms of social justice you would think of in the situation of civil rights, that the people who are speaking out and protesting actually have a right to be heard. They should be heard, and that's the socially just thing. And it was one of the problems with the Old South when we were covering it back in the old days of Southern journalism. There's another ethical tradition that's also fairly new. It's called bioethics or environmental ethics. Aldo Leopold was an early proponent of the land ethic, and it's a movement to broaden the scope of virtue, consequence, justice, and duty ethics from the purely human realm to other living things and include the web of life as well. In all of these cases, though, these are things that we might do intuitively, but it's good to have labels for them because it's easier to analyze the long-term balancing act that you have to do for these kinds of ethical dilemmas that are definitely going to come up. Now, in terms of religious traditions, we're all familiar with the Christian golden rule, love your neighbor, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Most of us are familiar with the Ten Commandments, which is a Christian, Judeo, and Islamic tradition. Islam is surrender to the will of God, so you do what God tells you to do. For people from the Hindu tradition, the idea is ahimsa, you don't harm any living thing. The Buddhists have the Eightfold Path, which is right views, right aspirations, right speech, right conduct, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. And that's all fairly specific, but these are things that maybe are specific. These are all things that are specific to the cultures, but they have a good deal in common. And these are moral principles that are usually derived from the ethical traditions and influenced by the religious traditions as well. So you would, for example, use a tradition of autonomy that people should make their... This is especially important in medical research. For instance, people have to have informed consent in order to be involved in a research project. There's the non-malfeasance, do no harm. Again, a very old medical tradition, but one that applies to just about everybody. And as you can see from the Hindu tradition, that's something that is very ancient. Do no harm to any living thing. There's beneficence. You should try to help people. There's justice. You treat all people alike and fairly. There's fidelity. You honor commitments to people you serve. And there's truthfulness. So all of these different things that I'm mentioning along the way are things that we all know, but have to put into practice almost on a daily basis. And sometimes we're challenged in a very large way. And when you have some ethical tools to think about, what would be virtuous, what's my duty, what are the consequences, and where's the social justice part of the equation, those can really help you think through these sorts of problems. There's another side of this I'll just mention really briefly, which is ethical orientation. And people have a psychological orientation a lot of times towards either communitarian or libertarian sorts of loyalties. A communitarian person might be more egalitarian or altruistic or economically liberal, but perhaps socially conservative, whereas libertarians tend to be elitist and individualistic, socially liberal, and oftentimes economically conservative. And that's a lens through which a lot of individuals and cultures view ethical behavior. So are we oriented really towards the greater good of the community or the greater good of the individual? Who bears the ultimate value, the individual or the community? And those are questions that also have to be answered as well. In terms of professional ethics, we should talk about that. When we think about what is right and wrong in a profession, we think about what's prescriptive and what's proscriptive, what you should do and what you should not do. So for the mass media, there was the Hutchins Commission on Freedom of the Press that issued a report in 1947 that was still, that is still today used as kind of a baseline for ethical requirements for the media. And what the Hutchins Commission said was that the media should provide truthful, comprehensive, intelligent accounts of the day's events in a context that gives them meaning. That's the first one. Second one, the media should serve as a forum for the exchange of comment and criticism. The media should also project a representative picture of the constituent groups of a society, and the media should present and clarify the goals and values of a society, and the media should also provide full access to the day's intelligence. Obviously, in terms of the Hutchins Commission, my civil rights demonstration ethical problem would run up against these ethical, these professional ethical positions, because obviously I'm not presenting a representative picture and I'm not providing full access to the day's intelligence if I'm not writing the story about a civil rights demonstration. So from that standpoint, the ethical thing to do is to go ahead and write the story, and the newspaper should have printed it, and indeed they did eventually print it after a lot of arguing in the newsroom, but it was good. It was very healthy for them to do that. And that kind of leads me to the Society of Professional Journalists ethical code, in a sense that journalists are supposed to be accountable. That's one of the major principles. They're supposed to clarify and explain news coverage and invite dialogue in a newsroom and also with the public over the way news is covered. Journalists are also supposed to act independently, avoid conflicts of interest, free of associations and activities that might compromise integrity or damage credibility. They're not supposed to take gifts or favors or free travel, and they're supposed to be to minimize harm, especially to people who might be affected adversely by news coverage, and to use special sensitivity dealing with children or inexperienced sources or subjects. Or another example that we used a little bit earlier was the witnesses to a crime whose identity need to be shielded in order to for justice to take place. Obviously, when you seek the truth and report it, which is the principal ethical guideline for professional journalists, you're supposed to test the accuracy of information from everyone. I had a student not too long ago who uncovered a story about a tanning salon in Radford, Virginia, and the tanning salon owner said, oh, all this stuff about tanning and cancer, it's all really just nonsense. And the reporter never bothered to check. And if you Google for tanning and cancer, you find the World Health Organization and the Centers for Disease Control are actually very concerned about that. Now, ethically, that sort of information needs to be in any story about a tanning salon. And even if you do pass on some of the remarks or the positions of the salon owners, you certainly have a responsibility to test the accuracy of the information that they may give you. Now, that is a major ethical imperative for not just for journalists, but for everybody who is passing information along in the media. So people in advertising and public relations are also bound to tell the truth and substantiate the claims and follow the laws and regulations that relate to public relations and advertising. Federal Trade Commission, as we'll be talking about in the section on advertising, sets up those regulations. And in doubt, go ahead. There's a great website. You can go ahead and check it. You don't lie and you don't cheat people and you don't offend good taste or public decency to the extent that that's consistent with your publication's ethical position. So people in advertising and public relations need to read the PRSA and AAF codes of ethics here. In web design, you're going to end up with photography, journalism, and advertising. So web designers need to be aware of all of these different professional ethical codes. They also need to be aware of special issues like privacy, and Facebook is a big deal these days, setting cookies, collecting and selling data, and nuisance issues like interstitial advertising and questions about copyright. All of these really have to be understood by people in the web design or computer science area as well. So there's another aspect of ethics that people are probably aware of, which has to do with photography and how much there are issues in terms of graphic representation as well. And on the website, there's a link at the bottom of the ethics page to ethical photos. And you can see one of them very recently has come up in the June issue of The Economist. You have a photo of President Barack Obama standing with three people at a big oil rig offshore, and he's got his head kind of bowed. And in the cropped photo, one of the people is taken out, and in the Photoshop photo, Another one is taken out, and on the cover of The Economist, you've got, the president looking downcast and pretty beaten down by this oil spill thing. And in fact, that's not what the picture originally said. Now, The Economist didn't apologize for using the writer's photo that way. They said they were just dramatizing the news. But it's interesting, the next section from the Iraq War, there's a photo, it's a composite photo in which a soldier appears to be telling a man with a child to sit down. But the two photos from which this is drawn tell a very different story. The photographer who was responsible for those photos was dismissed from the LA Times 2 days after the composite came to light. So take a look at that one as well. In the Hurricane Katrina case, there are some captions that are very interesting. In one, this is an Associated Press photo, a young man walks through chest-deep floodwater after looting a grocery store in New Orleans. In another, two residents, and this is an agency France Press Getty photo, two residents wade through chest-deep water after finding bread and soda from a local grocery store during Hurricane Katrina. Now, unfortunately, the young man who's been looting is black, and the two residents who have found some bread and soda are white. And I don't know if prejudice played a large part in that particular ethical decision. These are two different agencies, after all. But AP tends to take a somewhat more conservative view of things than the agency France Presse. So I'm not really sure how that works out. I do know that it's unethical to say that somebody who hasn't had food or water and goes into an abandoned grocery store would be looting it, especially when we all know what happened in Hurricane Katrina. So I think there's a lack of sensitivity, a remarkable lack of sensitivity sometimes in the media. We certainly see that in the O.J. Simpson coverage as well. There were two covers of news magazines, Newsweek and Time magazine, and in one of them, Simpson's face is heavily darkened. I guess this was 1994. Simpson's face is heavily darkened, and he's made to look a lot more sinister than in the Newsweek cover photo. The editors did apologize for that. They said it was definitely the wrong thing to do, and there was a lesson learned there. But one of the ways we learn these ethical lessons and apply them to our professional ethical standards is to go back and look at the history and the background of some of the issues that have been faced by people before us. So this is a fairly quick look at ethical tools and dilemmas that are faced by the mass media. We'll be talking more about those as we go along into specific areas of mass media law, but it's important to remember that a sense of ethics is what protects you as a professional, and that when you have a feeling that something seems wrong, you need to go all the way through the ethical toolkit and really consider what your professional responsibility is, what the consequences are, what would be the right thing to do, and what is the socially just thing to do. And to fall back on some of these great ethical guidelines like the SPJ or the AAF or the PRSA Code of Ethics, also the Hutchins Commission, also the Press Photographers Association Guideline to Privacy and Ethics, all of these can give us the kind of moral compass that we need to pursue a very difficult profession with a great deal of potential for harm and a great deal of potential for social good. These are very important things to remember. So thank you, and with that we'll go ahead and close out this section, and we'll look forward to seeing you in the fourth podcast on libel law. Thanks.